Welcome to the Fitness to Dive podcast. I am Dr. David Charish. I am a dive medicine physician, board certified in emergency medicine and undersea and hyperbaric medicine. A question every diver should ask themselves prior to any dive is, am I fit to dive? As a hyperbaric physician and diving consultant, I work with the diving community to evaluate and treat diving-related issues. As an educator, I offer lectures, workshops, seminars, and symposium on all aspects of dive safety, dive technology, and dive medicine. A question every diver should ask themselves prior to any dive is, am I fit to dive? Understanding what constitutes fitness to dive is key to our ability to process this information and allow for effective decision making. In a real world example, as a diver with a dive trip scheduled and now with a new medical diagnosis and recently prescribed medication, what information do you need to both absorb this information about your medical condition and have the cognitive ability to make an informed decision? We will have conversations with leaders in the fields of dive safety, dive technology, dive medicine, and most importantly, divers. These podcasts will explore the many aspects of fitness to dive. We can better understand our fitness to dive as we address these six areas: medical fitness, psychological fitness, nutrition, physical fitness, knowledge, and physical skill. So whether you are a recreational diver, technical diver, public safety diver, scientific diver, commercial diver, military diver, or free diver, understanding your fitness to dive will make your diving safer and more enjoyable. Please join me on this important conversation on fitness to dive. This is Dr. David Charish, dive medicine physician of Dive Medicine and Hyperbaric Consultants. Hope to see you soon. Michael Rothschild is a pediatric ear, nose, and throat specialist in New York City. He completed his undergraduate and medical school education at Yale University, his otolaryngology residency at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York, and his fellowship in pediatric otolaryngology at the Children's Hospital in Cincinnati, Ohio. He is a clinical professor of otolaryngology and pediatrics at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. Dr. Rothschild has published 44 peer-reviewed articles, a book, and 29 book chapters, and other invited works. He has served as president of the American Bronchoesophagological Association and the New York Pediatric Society. He has received a number of honors and awards, including the ABEA Guest of Honor and the Chevalier Jackson Award, and he has been on the New York Magazine's Best Doctor list from 2010 to 2021. Dr. Rothschild is a technical rebreather diver and avid underwater photographer and videographer. He has published a children's book of images of sea creatures of the New York area. He is past president and current dive chair of the New York City Sea Gypsies and the co-director of the New York Underwater Photography Society. He is also a medical moderator for scubaboard.com. Dr. Mike is a strong believer in diving locally and is a mentor to many in the Northeast diving community. He lectures widely on topics related to ENT issues in diving, underwater photography, and safe diving practices for open circuit and rebreather divers. Great to have you here, Dr. Rothschild.
Oh, great to be here. Thanks very much for having me, Dave.
So the first thing I have to ask, when was the last time you were diving?
Well, unfortunately, I have been dry and out of the water for the last 36 hours. And it's very hard to be out of the water that long. I was diving Saturday night. I did a midnight night dive at the Belmar Beach out on the South Jetty, and I had a spectacular dive with a lot of cool stuff. I was shooting video that time with some frame grabs, and that was a lot of fun. But just got to work this week, and then I'll be back in the water next weekend.
Well, the water will always be there for
yes,
you.
Yes, I certainly hope it will be.
So on your office website, you have a number of great educational articles and publications on a variety of topics. One of those topics features swimmer's ear. Oh, how common is swimmer's ear?
Swimmer's ear is very painful. I mean, if you're a diver, you've had swimmer's ear, you know it's sad. I'm a pediatric ENT doc. I take care of some parents in my practice. I have had moms tell me that swimmer's ear is comparable with childbirth. I mean, it is really can be agony. And what swimmer's ear, of course, is, it's a skin inflammation of the outer ear. The outer ear is the space, the tube that goes from the side of your head in and ends at the eardrum. And it's lined with skin. And swimmer's ear is more like diaper rash or athlete's foot. It happens whenever you have a space which is relatively warm and relatively moist. And if you're swimming a lot or even just from sweating a lot, in the summer, people will get swimmer's ear. You don't have to play tennis to get tennis elbow. You don't have to swim to get swimmer's ear, but it is certainly common in divers. And there are things you can do to make it less likely, but once you get it, it can be quite difficult to treat without a good cleaning of the ear canal, topical drops, and keeping the ear really, really dry while you're healing.
So if you have a swimmer's ear, then you shouldn't be diving until it's treated properly.
You really want to stay out of the water. I mean, it's not going to get better. Unlike other things that we're going to talk about, you may not cause permanent injury, but it's certainly not going to get better, and it is very uncomfortable. And really, just like, you know, you can't treat diaper rash without changing the diaper, you can't treat athlete's foot without changing your socks. You got to keep the ear dry, and that means staying out of the water. And there are actually devices you can get to help dry the ear. They're sort of like a little miniature hair dryer type thing that blows warm air into the ear. That's helpful for both preventing swimmer's ear by drying your ear after frequent exposure and for treating it. So I recommend those a lot. Generally, it's a good idea to have an ENT exam if you have a bad swimmer's ear, because a lot of times either there's trapped debris, like wet earwax that traps moisture, and you have that, no matter how much you use drops and antibiotics and steroids, it's not going to get better until you clean that out. Or if the ear canal is so swollen and so narrow, the drops aren't going to get in. And in that case, we sometimes put in something called a wick, which is a little, looks like a candle wick, and you put it in the ear canal, and it helps bring the drops into the deeper portions of the ear canal until the swelling goes down and you can get the drops in.
So at what point after you've been adequately treated can you return to diving?
For swimmer's ear, it's when you feel better. Most people kind of know when the worst of it's over. And then if you're prone to swimmer's ear, either because the ear canal is small, some people have bony growths in the ear canal that trap moisture. I have that. It's called surfer's ear. They're these bony growths, and they trap wax and debris and whatnot in there. So if you're prone to swimmer's ear for any reason, it's a good idea to be proactive about it, to use an ear dryer. There are topical sprays you can use, like Ear Shield, which is a spray of natural oils that coats the ear canal, especially if you're diving in fresh water. It's often more of a problem than in salt water. And then there are the drops, either antibiotic and steroid drops, which are used to treat a swimmer's ear, or occasionally people will use drops to prevent swimmer's ear, what divers call ear beer. The standard recommendation is half alcohol, half white vinegar, but really that's too much white vinegar. You want as little water in the mixture as possible. And one of the easiest way to make this is you get some of this swim ear stuff. It's a topical commercial preparation. It's basically 95% isopropyl alcohol with a little glycerin in it to keep from over drying. And what I always recommend is adding a little bit of white vinegar to that. Not a lot, just if you have a 1 ounce bottle, add about a teaspoon of white vinegar. Half teaspoon of white vinegar is usually enough. And what that does is it drops the pH. The bacteria that causes swimmer's ear, most commonly Pseudomonas bacteria, does not like low pH, does not like acid environments. So by dropping that, you don't need a lot of vinegar to drop that pH, it makes it much more effective. So the alcohol dries the ear, displacing moisture and dries it out, and the vinegar drops the pH, and the glycerin keeps from over drying.
Excellent. The most common diving-related illness is otic bowel trauma. That is pressure-related changes causing a problem within the middle or inner ear. Can you explain a little bit in more detail what is otic barotrauma and how does it occur?
Sure. I mean, barotrauma is a problem in many areas of the body with diving. And the idea is that when we're breathing compressed gas underwater, when we are at high ambient pressure, we have to equalize the pressure between the airfield spaces in our body and the ambient pressure. And that's the whole idea behind equalizing when you're diving, equalizing your ears, clearing your ears, making sure your sinuses are clear. The air-filled spaces being the middle ears and the sinuses, there's sometimes gas capped under the tooth. Now there's air in the airway as well, in the lungs, but that normally equalizes naturally because you're breathing from a regulator, your airway is open, so the pressure in your airway is going to be at ambient pressure because that's what the regulator does. The regulator, again, we're talking about open circuit diving, the regulator delivers gas at ambient pressure. So there's really no pressure differential in the lungs unless you have scar in your pneumothorax or a bleb or something unusual like that. Whereas in the ears are connected to the airway by this very narrow tube called the Eustachian tube. It runs from the back of the ears to the back of the nose. And one of the skills that every diver has to have is the ability to equalize, to open that tube when you're descending so that the pressure differential doesn't build up. And middle ear barotrauma happens when you don't keep up with that change in pressure. If you keep descending and you have a hard time equalizing and you're getting pain, but instead of stopping and ascending again and working through it, you just keep on going and try to push through it, that's never going to work. And that's how you get into a situation where you may damage your eustachian tube to the point where you can't equalize in that dive. You may end up with permanent damage to the ear. So it's very important to not push through that and to always equalize, even if it takes a long time. Buddies should know it's going to take a while to get down. Take a while to get down. Don't rush it.
Yeah, so just expand on that incident when the diver's first feeling a little bit of ear pain discomfort. What should the diver do at that moment?
So what the pain you're feeling is the eardrum being stretched. And think about the space behind the eardrum is the middle ear. It's an air-filled space, and it's connected to the ambient pressure, to the airway pressure, by that eustachian tube. So if that tube isn't opening properly when you're descending, you're building up a differential in pressure between ambient pressure outside the eardrum and the space behind the eardrum, the middle ear. So as you're descending, you start to feel that pressure. That's when you stop. And you stop and you try to equalize. Now, there are a lot of different ways of equalizing. Most people use the Valsalva maneuver, where you pinch your nose and blow. There's the Toynbee maneuver, where you pinch your nose and swallow. There's a whole list of them I actually give out to people. Usually when people say they can't equalize, it's almost always a technique problem. It's almost never a structural or anatomical problem with the eustachian tube. So you try one of these procedures, whatever works for you, until you can get it to open. And if you can't get it open, then you ascend a little bit and try again. It's always harder to equalize on descent than ascent, because think about it like a toothpaste tube. It's easier to squeeze toothpaste out of the tube than it is to put it back in. So when you're descending, you're basically trying to force extra gas into the middle ear, right? Because the ambient pressure is increased, so you have to equalize that by pushing gas from your airway into the eustachian tube. When you're ascending, the air is escaping from the middle ear, so when you're ascending, the ambient pressure is dropping faster than this pressure in the middle ear, so the gas tends to squirt out through the eustachian tube more easily. Now, it is possible to have a problem on ascent. That's the so-called reverse block. But that's less common, just because it's easier to get air to come out of the middle ear than it is to push it in. So that's when you stop, ascend a little bit, and try again. And keep on going slowly, keep on going carefully, and don't do anything crazy. Don't push through it.
Absolutely. Now, I also know that you can actually rupture your eardrum if you push too hard.
That's true. So eventually, your eardrum's like the burst disc in a scuba tank. At some point, it may give way because it's just a thin, relatively thin membrane. It's got layers of skin on the outside and mucosa on the inside and a fibrous layer in between. And so if that pressure differential builds up, and at first you get pain, and then eventually it's just going to give, and you can get a perforation of the eardrum. And that can cause a lot of problems. Number one, it's rare that doesn't heal by itself, but it may take weeks for it to heal by itself. And then in the course of a dive, you have a sudden rush of cold water into your middle ear. That can cause vertigo, that can cause disorientation, that can actually put you in a situation where you're at risk of going into a panic spiral and having a real dive accident.
Sure.
Plus it's painful and disorienting.
Say a diver has otic barotrauma, mm-hmm. can't get down to the dive, comes to the surface and has persistent ear pain. Right. What should the diver do next?
Well, that's pretty unusual, because generally when you come up, it gets better. So what you're describing is more like a reverse block. But first of all, if you have a question of middle ear barotrauma, meaning it fits the profile, you had pain on descent. You know, there are a lot of different types of ear problems in diving, which we can talk about later. You have pain on descent, and you come up, you still have pain, that chances are that means you have some kind of reverse block, meaning that the pressure, even at the surface, is not equalized. So that's where you need to see somebody and see, number one, if the eardrum ruptures, actually you should no longer have pain because you suddenly have equalized the pressure. That's what ear tubes do in children. They equalize the pressure. They basically are a way of bypassing that dysfunctional eustachian tube. They let air in and out of the middle ear, but obviously you don't want that when you're scuba diving. Generally, if you have severe ear pain and suddenly it feels better, that's often a sign of a perforation. You need to keep the ear dry for it to heal. You should have your hearing tested, make sure there's nothing more than just middle ear barotrauma, because sometimes middle ear barotrauma can lead to inner ear barotrauma, which can be permanent hearing loss. So you do need a good exam at that point and probably a hearing test, and keep the ear dry until it's healed up and you can equalize again.
So basically, to return to diving after otic bowel trauma is to be symptom-free, and if you've been seen by a medical provider, to be cleared to return to diving.
Yeah, I mean, I think the most important thing to do is make sure it's just otic middle ear barotrauma and nothing more, that you didn't get inner ear decompression sickness or inner ear barotrauma or something like that that would require more than just rest. And maybe the gentle Valsalva maneuvers, the 20 beam maneuvers to help ventilate your ear. Your ear is an incredibly sensitive pressure sensor, so that's the best way of telling when you're ready to go back to diving. Assuming you didn't have a perforation or any kind of significant ear injury, you just had barotrauma, maybe built some fluid or blood built up behind the eardrum, you're going to know when it's okay to dive, when you can equalize again. I always tell people, like, if you've had a case of middle ear barotrauma, don't go on some expensive dive trip until you can get into a pool and just see if you can equalize. You should be able to tell, if you're having a problem, you should be able to tell that problem within relatively shallow water. And no matter what a doctor tells you, no matter what the audiologist tells you, no matter what CT scans you get, whatever, nothing's as good as checking to see if you can equalize in a safe, confined water environment. And so that's how you tell. If you can equalize, that means your eustachian tube is working again and you're probably safe.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. Let's talk about sinus barotrauma.
Oh boy, I've had that.
Okay.
That is not fun.
So what is sinus barotrauma?
So just like middle ear barotrauma, it's gas trapped in an air-filled space that's not well connected, not well ventilated into the airway. So the sinuses are these air-filled spaces, and they are in the skull, and they connect through very small openings into the nasal airway. So just like the ears, when you're diving and the pressure in your airway and your lungs and throat and everything increases to match ambient pressure, which of course it has to do, otherwise you get lung injury, which we're not talking about. Ideally, the sinuses should equalize at the same rate, and they often don't. And that can be because of congenital problems or anatomical problems with your sinus drainage pathways. Some people just have poor ventilation of these sinuses. Other people have sinus disease, which means they have chronic inflammation, which causes the lining of the sinuses to swell, to become what's called polypoid, and that can obstruct those little drainage pathways. And so just like with the ears, you need to be able to equalize. It's less common to have sinus barotrauma, but it certainly happens. I had a case, I was diving, and I was able to equalize my sinuses, and I got down to the bottom on ascent. I had pain, so I had a reverse block, and that's, you know, as the pilots say, takeoffs are optional, landings are mandatory. Same thing with diving, you know, descents are optional, ascents are mandatory. So you're in the bottom and it hurts a lot going up. And I could tell it was, as I ascended, the compressed gas in my sinuses and in my face was trying to expand and not getting out. So that caused excruciating pain in my face, but you gotta come up. So I'm sitting there on the dive boat in agony. And suddenly, you know, I'm trying to work it out, and suddenly there's this explosive decompression of blood and snot into my mask, and it was the best feeling of my life. It just felt such an incredible relief to get that pain and pressure decompressed, as you can tell. Now, one of the things about sinus barotrauma is you don't have quite the same delicate little mechanisms as you do in the ear. So you don't worry about so much about perforated eardrums, you don't worry so much about inner ear damage, permanent hearing loss. It is possible to get a serious injury from a sinus barotrauma. It's much less common. The air can track, instead of tracking into the inner ear, it can actually track into the space around the eyes. There's even cases of intracranial air injury, where if you had an unanticipated break in this lining of the sinuses, because sinuses are right next to the brain, and there's a very thin wall between the sinuses and the brain. And there are cases where people have had what's called pneumocephalus, which is air cracking into the brain, and obviously that's life-threatening, potentially life-threatening. So not to diminish sinus barotrauma, because it's not as they're dangerous in different ways, but true life-threatening injury or vision-threatening injury from sinus barotrauma is less common.
So any pain in the sinuses that don't resolve after your diving should be evaluated by a medical provider at some point.
Yeah, and we're getting a little ahead of ourselves, but that's the kind of thing where medical therapy might be more helpful. Right. There is very limited evidence that decongestants, topical decongestants, or oral decongestants help with ear equalization, but they do help with sinus equalization. So that would be the case where if you're on a tropical island and you have a sinus barotrauma and you still have some pain, that's where some Afrin, some decongestants might really, really help and probably won't hurt.
And so you shouldn't return to diving until you're symptom-free.
Same kind of guidelines. You try it in a pool, see if you can equalize. Sure. If you can't equalize, don't push it.
Great. Another problem divers may experience is a condition called vertigo.
Right.
What is vertigo?
Well, vertigo isn't a disease so much as a symptom. It's a subjective sensation of motion of the environment. I mean, there are a lot of these things overlap. They're all inner ear, what's called labyrinthine symptoms. The inner ear is divided into the portion that controls hearing, the portion that controls balance. So these are often inner ear labyrinthine symptoms, and they will give you the sensation of the room spinning, nausea, vomiting, that kind of thing. It's not uncommon to have a sudden disorienting case of dizziness underwater, and like as I said before, that can be very, very dangerous.
So if you're diving and you get a sudden episode of vertigo mm-hmm. or dizziness, mm-hmm. what should you do at that moment?
Well, first, just keep breathing. I would abort the dive safely, a safe, slow ascent. All of us may have a little brief transient right. episode of nothing and they feel better. I'm not talking about that. But if you have persistent, significant vertigo, the room's spinning, you're disoriented, that's the time to abort the dive. Hopefully you have a buddy with you who can help you get up. Oftentimes you can try to figure out what it might be. There is something called ultanobaric vertigo, where it's a differential ventilation of the two ears. And you can try gently equalizing. That sometimes helps. Sometimes it's a caloric response. If you're wearing a tight-fitting hood and cold water and one ear got a rush of cold water, the other didn't, that's the kind of thing where you might be able to adjust that and treat it underwater. If it's something like inner ear barotrauma, you're not really going to be able to fix that underwater. But the idea is to just make a slow, safe ascent, because if it gets worse and all of a sudden you can't figure out where you are and you can't make a descent, that's where you can turn from an annoyance or a potentially ear-threatening issue to a potentially life-threatening issue.
Sure. There are some people that have a pre-existing condition with chronic vertigo, and right. if they choose to dive, at what point is it safe to dive?
You're talking about vertigo that's not related to diving.
Not related some to diving,
like
exactly.
Paroxysmal yeah. vertigo. Yeah, well, I mean, most people who have those kind of conditions know themselves. If you are, it's sort of like people who have seizure disorders and driving. I mean, if you know that at any moment you might have debilitating episode of vertigo, scuba diving might not be the best activity to do. And, usually that's a decision that's made before you get training. It's unusual for somebody who is an avid scuba diver to suddenly develop this, but certainly that would be a consideration as whether or not it's safe to continue to dive. If it's really unpredictable and severe and debilitating, that doesn't go well with diving.
Right.
It's sort of like seizure disorder.
Sure. Recently I've seen a patient who experiences vertigo every time he dives recently, where he's had hundreds of dives without that problem. Mm-hmm. I examined him. He had a normal exam,
right.
but I recommend he follow up with the ear, nose, and throat right. for more extensive evaluation.
Right. Well, I mean, that's a different situation. Now, if he's having vertigo when he dives, as opposed to just randomly having vertigo that happens to happen when he dives, in other words, if there's something about the pressure differential
right.
that's causing it, that needs an investigation. It may need something more than just a routine exam. Like, for instance, he might need a CT scan of the temporal bone. Suppose he has a dehiscence of one of the ear canals. That's, something sometimes people have bony abnormalities which result in transmission of pressure from the ambient environment to the inner ear. Some people have something called a widened vestibular aqueduct. And again, those are things you really develop. Those are things you're born with. But it's possible something like that could be happening. There are all kinds of inner ear conditions. I mean, who knows? You could have acoustic neuroma.
Sure.
And you can actually test balance. Hearing testing is very commonly done in most ENT doctors' offices. Balance testing is a little more sophisticated and usually done in special labs, but there are ways of testing the inner ear balance mechanism and trying to see if there's a problem with one of the labyrinths, and maybe you can find something that can be done. And there's sometimes things that can be done to address that.
Sure. So having persistent or continuous symptoms certainly requires further evaluation.
Right. And especially if it happens during diving.
Absolutely. So we've talked about middle ear barotrauma. We've talked about eustachian tube mm-hmm. dysfunction. What is inner ear barotrauma?
Okay, so the inner ear, there are three portions of the ear, outer, middle, and inner. Outer ear is where we talk about that skin-lined tube that's the eardrum and out. Middle ear is the space behind the eardrum. It's an air-filled space. It's basically an extension of the nasal airway. Then the inner ear is basically an extension of the brain. It's deep within the what's called the temporal bone. It's a skull base. And the middle ear is connected to the inner ear by a little vibrating bone. There are three little bones that connect the eardrum to the inner ear. And so when you hear sound, it vibrates the eardrum, vibrates these three little bones. The third bone, the stapes, sits in a hole in that otic capsule, that temporal bone. and the vibrations are transmitted into the inner ear. The inner ear is a very different kind of place. It's a sterile place. It's got different types of fluid in there that are basically an extension of cerebrospinal fluid and inner ear fluids, and normally it's never opened. So damage to that connection between the middle and the inner ear with leakage of fluids can cause permanent damage. And there are a number of ways that can happen, like severe, sudden change in middle ear pressure, like with you weren't able to clear your ears and suddenly with a forceful valve salvage just pops open and you have a rapid change in pressure that can push that stapes foot plate, that little bone, into the inner ear and get to the point where you can actually tear one of the membranes and actually cause a leakage of fluid. And that can cause a permanent hearing loss or vertigo right away. That's inner ear barotrauma. It can happen with just a forceful valsalva if you have one of those other conditions, like the widened vestibular aqueduct. It can transmit pressure. When you strain and you have valsalva, it increases the pressure in the brain, the cerebrospinal fluid pressure. That can be transmitted to the inner ear, and that can cause rupture of those membranes from the other direction. And those can be very difficult to diagnose, and it can be very serious. Inner ear barotrauma, more commonly involved with hearing loss, but you can also have vertigo, oral fullness, that kind of thing. So treatment for that is usually, if you diagnose it, is just rest. Sometimes people use steroids, elevating the head of the bed, avoiding straining people, put people on stool softeners. In a rare case, if it doesn't get better, you may actually have surgery. You can explore the middle ear and look for one of these little leaks that can be very hard to see. There's no real good test to determine them ahead of time. You can't see it on a CT scan. Sometimes the only thing you can do is explore the ear and look for that leak and try to patch it. And you may or may not get good recovery of function.
So if I am diagnosed with inner ear barotrauma, can I return to diving?
Again, it would depend on your degree of recovery. I mean, there's no reason, it's not an absolute contraindication to diving in the future, assuming that everything heals up. But certainly if you had like a perilymph fistula repair, it would be months before you would even dare to test that, you know, and you'd want to make sure your surgeon signed off on that and go gently because it's a repair. Like
sure.
The other part, same thing with repairing an eardrum. You got to make sure it's completely healed before you go stress it again.
So then the common complaints or signs of a inner ear barotrauma would be what then?
Well, it's most commonly hearing loss, occasionally with vertigo. It usually happens during the dive, like I said, during either a forceful valsalva or a sudden decompression or a sudden equalization. You can have ear fullness, you know, sort of a sensation of the ear is full, even on the surface. You can test hearing loss and balance. There are things you can test on the boat, like you can look for things like nystagmus, the beating of the eyes. That's a sign of an inner ear injury. You may be able to see that on a dive boat. Other stuff needs more elaborate testing.
So those persistent symptoms absolutely need to be evaluated.
Any question of inner ear disease, you need to see an ENT. And you shouldn't dive until you figure out what's going on.
So let's talk a little bit about inner ear decompression sickness. The mechanism of the injury is related to off-gassing when there is a change in ambient pressure. So based on Henry's law, if, for example, nitrogen is in the inner ear as we ascend, that change in ambient pressure, the gas, the nitrogen, comes out of solution and can cause decompression sickness if the nitrogen happens to be in the inner ear.
Right.
So what are some of the signs and symptoms of inner ear decompression sickness?
Sure. And in a way, a lot of them overlap with inner ear barotrauma, and it is important to make that distinction. Just talk about the etiology a little bit. I mean, you're the hyperbaric doc, and you know about decompression sickness, and it is decompression sickness just like it is elsewhere in the body. But there are some things that are a little different in the inner ear. It's not exactly clear what causes inner ear decompression sickness, you know, the actual mechanism. One theory is that there are bubbles that form in the inner ear tissues. In other words, you ascend, your tissues are near critical supersaturation, you ascend to a certain point where they become out of solution and they directly cause trauma. They can cause inflammatory reaction to the lining of the blood vessels in the inner ear. That's one possible explanation, basically sort of like you'd get a hit anywhere else in a joint or anything, the bubbles form there. The other possibility, and there's some evidence to support this, is that it's a type of arterial gas embolism. It's a type of decompression illness. And what that means is instead of the bubbles necessarily forming in the inner ear, they form elsewhere in the body, and then they get into the end arteries that feed the labyrinth by crossing over from the venous side of circulation to the arterial side. And you've probably heard about things like Peyton Frayman Avalli or other shunts that basically take bubbles, where bubbles can go from the left side of the circulation, the venous side, bypass the normally those bubbles, everybody bubbles when they ascend from a dive. There's always going to be bubbles formed. Normally, they go through the lungs, they're filtered out by the lungs. if the blood somehow bypasses the lungs, and that's something like a patent foramen ovale or a shunt within the lung or something like that, then those bubbles don't get the chance to get filtered out. Now they're on the arterial side, and the arterial vessels get smaller and smaller. And eventually those bubbles, can basically act like an embolism. And sort of like a stroke, is when a blood clot goes into an artery and goes up and lodges in the brain and causes tissue to die downstream. Same kind of thing. If a bubble gets into one of the arteries that feeds the inner ear, that can cause trauma that way.
It's important to distinguish inner ear barotrauma from inner ear decompression sickness, because I think the treatment is going to be clearly different.
Not only is the treatment different, I mean, treatment for decompression sickness is just the same. Inner ear decompression sickness is the same as the treatment for decompression sickness elsewhere.
Right.
Oxygen, hydration, and recompression.
Right.
The only thing is if you actually have inner ear barotrauma, there is a theoretical risk that the recompression could actually make it worse.
Right.
So you kind of want to do, and there are some authors who actually recommend doing meningotomy tubes. You're making holes in the eardrums before a chamber ride if you're not sure, just because not much of a downside. And if there was a problem, then you wouldn't be transmitting more pressure to the inner ear with the recompression chamber. So I think that's not really borne out in actual practice. Usually you can make the distinction between the two. So how would you tell the difference between inner ear decompression sickness and inner ear barotrauma? Well, you could look at the dive. Decompression sickness, we all know, there's such thing as an undeserved hit, and not everybody has broken their non-deco limits and everything, but certainly are there things that make it riskier. Big nitrogen loading, high decompression stress, multiple ascents, rapid ascents, you know, things that you get penalized for by your dive computer. These are things that increase decompression stress. You kind of think, oh, I have my magic bracelet on my wrist. It says I didn't go into deco. I didn't reach deco limits. Therefore, there's no way I can get I can get a hit. But that's not true. You and I know that's not true. There's plenty of so-called undeserved hits. And the thing is there's a lot of things that put you at risk for decompression stress. So if you look at the dive profile and see, are any of those things there? Also, you look at the timing. Inner ear barotrauma typically happens, you know, during the dive, when you make that forceful change.
On descent,
yeah,
typically.
On descent, yeah. Or it could be on ascent, rare on descent, like if you're doing a forceful equalization. Whereas decompression sickness, typically there's a symptom-free interval. So you surface, usually it's like 20, 30 minutes later, up to about 2 hours later, that you start getting symptoms. So, you know, something like that would make it much more likely to be inner ear decompression sickness than inner ear barotrauma. So you could look at that and you can kind of figure out what it is. You may see, if you look at the ears with inner ear decompression sickness, they should look normal, because it's not a barotrauma problem. It's an ascent. It's a decompression phenomenon. Whereas somebody who has a inner ear barotrauma often will also have middle ear disease, because the same forces that cause the inner ear damage may have also caused hemotympanum, blood behind the eardrum, that kind of thing. So you can usually tell the difference between which one is which. But the thing is, except for recompression, the initial treatment on a dive boat is always going to be the same. Even if you're not sure, O2 and hydration. I mean, obviously, if a patient's conscious, they can drink. And, you know, we can go into that, but that's beyond the realm of ENT.
Absolutely. Well, that's.
But I have seen several cases of inner ear decompression sickness on dive boats.
Right.
And I've seen them get better with oxygen.
And I think that we're not expecting divers to diagnose or differentiate one from the other, but realize an emergency exists and treat it as such.
Not going to go wrong with oxygen.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about a few common medications.
Sure.
So I know divers always talk about decongestants and antihistamines.
Right.
And so I think it's important to at least talk what they are, what they do, what are the side effects, and are they really helpful or harmful?
Sure. Well, there are a lot of over-the-counter and prescription medications that people use to treat ENT disease. And in this case, we're talking about things like nasal congestion. This is what we're talking about. So decongestants, systemic decongestants, are pills that you take or liquid that you take that cause blood vessels to shrink down and literally decongest the nose the nose is lined with this very with something called mucosa that has a very rich blood supply. There's structures called the turbinates that are fleshy structures with a lot of blood vessels in it. So by basically reducing the blood supply to the area, they'll literally shrink down this swollen tissue. So that's what an oral decongestant does. There's topical decongestants. And the main one that people use nowadays is Afrin. Afrin is great. I think there's three great medical inventions of the 20th century. There's penicillin, insulin, and Afrin. It's amazing. It works really well. It works really fast. The only thing about it is addictive. 3 days only. You see plenty of people who have been taking Afrin every day for a year. And what happens is it's like an addiction. You get physiologically addicted to it. You get a rebound, so you can't get off it. So really, if you use Afrin, it works great, but only 3 days only. So that actually is a topical spray, and you spray it on the in the front of the nose, and it'll decongest the nose. It does not get back to the eustachian tubes. The eustachian tubes are way in the back of the nose. There's no evidence that topical decongestants really help for eustachian tube dysfunction. That's a separate part of the nose. And it's easy to, you know, ENT, everybody kind of lumps everything together. It's all connected. Well, it is and it isn't. So that's topical decongestants. Now, antihistamines work in a different way. They really down-modulate the body's sort of allergic type responses. So they're useful, and this is like Zyrtec or Claritin, and they're useful for people who have allergies. A lot of people who have allergies and who dive will pre-treat themselves with these because that will help your nasal area, mainly for sinus barotrauma prevention. Doesn't really, not a lot of evidence it helps with ear disease, but they can be helpful, especially if you have allergies. They're really, that's what they're really designed for. There's topical nasal steroids, things like Flonase. Again, those are really more for nasal congestion. There's no evidence that they have any effect on the eustachian tube. They don't really even get back that far. And then there's oral steroids, which are occasionally used. I will occasionally use them to treat barotrauma. I'm a pediatric ENT doc, but I see a lot of divers for obvious reasons.
Sure.
A lot of times I'll see somebody who has middle ear fluid. And so the stepped approach to that is, well, first try just doing the Valsalva and the Twain beam maneuvers. And, you know, I tell them pinch your nose and blow, pinch your nose and swallow, see if you can clear it. Since you can't. So I'll give them a short course of steroids, something called a Medrol dose pack, which is a built-in taper dose of steroids, systemic steroids. What steroids do is they reduce inflammation. So they can help with this kind of inflammatory condition. They do have side effects. I mean, usually a short course of steroids is pretty well tolerated. Most of what people think of side effects are the side effects of long-term use. People use them for arthritis or for chemotherapy or that kind of thing with a swelling of the face. You don't really see that, but even a short course can cause stomach upset, irritability, things like that. So that's useful. And then, of course, if that doesn't work, occasionally I'll offer to do what's called an office myringotomy. It's usually an adult where you sort of numb up the eardrum and make a little hole in the eardrum and sort of like we do tubes in kids,
sure.
Make a hole in the eardrum and suction out the fluid. So those are the main sort of medical interventions. There's other ones. People use things like Singulair. Singulair is a different type of decongestion that works by a different mechanism. It's used more in allergies and asthma. There's topical antihistamines, things like Claritin and Zyrtec, but you spray them in the nose instead. But those are the main ones that people use.
And certainly as a diver, I'd want to have a conversation with my primary care doctor or my otolaryngologist right. If I had further questions
right.
or concerns.
Right. And for a primary care, that brings up a good point. There's some of these probably if you have significant heart disease, things like systemic decongestants or even topical ones can be, I mean, again, outside my area of expertise,
right.
You could probably tell me better than I could. But even some over-the-counter things can be dangerous if you have certain conditions. On the other hand, if you have such unstable cardiac disease, then maybe the better
exactly.
question is diving.
For example,
okay.
Pseudoephedrine can right. cause your blood pressure to be
right.
elevated
right.
as well
right.
as Afrin.
Exactly.
So
exactly.
certainly it's a good idea to have a conversation
right.
with your primary care doctor. Well, this has been a very informative conversation with Dr. Michael Rothschild.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Pediatric otolaryngologist located here in New York City. This is Dr. David Charish, dive medicine physician with Fitness and Diving. Stay tuned to our next podcast.
Stay tuned for our future podcast as we continue the conversation and take an in-depth look at medical fitness to dive, how medical fitness standards are developed, diving in the era of COVID-19, and understanding our underlying medical condition. We will introduce special guests in the fields of dive medicine, dive technology, and dive safety as we continue this conversation. This is Dr. David Charish from Dive Medicine and Hyperbaric Consultants, signing off for now.